From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
She loves eggs all different ways. She has her own names for all of them. She calls hard-boiled eggs knock eggies because you knock them on the counter to peel them. She calls fried eggs, over-easy eggs, flip eggies because I flip them for her, and she loves that moment when I can flip it in the pan.
That's Top Chef Judge Gail Simmons. She's been talking to me about how she really loves to cook with her daughter. Her love of food was shaped by her upbringing in a home that revolved around the kitchen. Gail's written about these memories and others in a new cookbook called Bringing It Home. It's hard to really believe that this is your first cookbook.
It's true. I've worked with other people on their cookbooks. I wrote a book 5 years ago, but it was a story, a memoir more, a partial memoir, I like to say, because I feel like it's not the end of my life.
Exactly.
But, you know, the part one, part two and three maybe will never be written. But I didn't feel like I had the confidence to write a cookbook for a long time, actually. More than I didn't have the confidence, just didn't know if I had 100 recipes that anyone else cared to cook.
It's amazing to me that no matter how accomplished we are, we still have these things that dog us.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you look at it objectively, like Flava Flav has a cookbook. So I knew that I could write a cookbook. Sure, anyone can write a cookbook if you put your mind to it. Apparently, you don't even really have to cook. But I didn't want that kind of cookbook. And I wanted a really personal cookbook that showed people the food, really, that I cook at home. This is not a cookbook of chefy chef recipes. It's recipes I've collected out in the universe in my adventures and travels from my mentors and the chefs I've worked with, both in my whole career and certainly on Top Chef.
The fact that your mother was a working mother and that she had this gig in food media is pretty unusual.
It is. And it's funny to hear you say that she had a gig in food media, because in the 70s and early 80s, we didn't think of it as food media. Like, that sounds very glamorous. That's what you do, Evan. That's what I do. But my mother, I don't even think people kind of categorized what she did yet because it was so unusual.
It was like the women's pages.
Yes. Although my mother's food writing appeared in the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's biggest newspaper, still is, and amazing. It's like, you know, the paper of record for Canada. So she wasn't just writing for, let's say, moms or only women. She wrote quite broadly, but the cooking school that she ran out of our kitchen in our house was certainly for the moms in the neighborhood to learn how to cook, because this was the early 80s and most moms weren't cooking. They were, for the first time, really entering the workforce and cooking out of the microwave. I mean, the microwave was the cool thing. I remember in 1982 when my mom brought home our first microwave and what a big deal that was. So she was actually trying to teach the women in the neighborhood, the moms, how to cook. And I remember it being a really big deal when one day she taught a cooking class for the men. And that was like a real moment of sort of hilarity and unusualness, because all the dads came to my house to do a cooking class and then cooked dinner for their wives. And that was like unheard of at the time.
Given that she was always calling you and your brothers into the kitchen, does that mean that you didn't help her? That it was separate? She felt that it was sort of her job?
Oh, no. I helped her a lot, and we spent a lot of time in the kitchen, but I just also remember we had homework and we would be playing with our friends. I mean, we weren't in the kitchen every day, for sure, but we spent all our time watching her cook. You know, the way she built our kitchen, we renovated our house in the early 80s so that we built our kitchen as a kitchen that went into it wasn't the dining room, we had a formal dining room, but a eating area, and then into a big family room so that she could stand at the counter and cook out while people watched her from the kitchen table and the den in the family room.
This is very radical.
Yes, it was. That was the center of our home, for sure.
In Bringing It Home, your new book, what is a recipe that you can give us that sort of brings back for you that time?
A few things. I have my mom's chopped liver in there. When I was young, it was definitely not necessarily my favorite thing that she made, but it was always in the fridge. I remember the green ceramic pot that she kept it in, which was just the chopped liver pot. It was the only thing that was in this pot, and it was always in the fridge, so she made her chopped liver. And when I called her for the recipe to make this book, she reeled it off to me without even having to look at a piece of paper. And I don't think she's made it in a couple of years. I mean, it's just ingrained in her soul.
Is it a schmaltz-based?
It definitely is a schmaltz-based chopped liver. You know, chicken livers sautéed with onions and other delicious things. I make a few tweaks. I add mustard into the actual mix.
Really?
I know. She probably hates me for it.
I love that. There's also a recipe in the book in which you reference a spaghetti sandwich.
Yes.
As the inspiration.
A sexy, sexy spaghetti sandwich, right? It's true. You know, these recipes come from everywhere. They're things that I wrote down that stuck in my mind. I can go through every trip I ever went on and tell you what we did based on what we ate there, because those are the memories I have of that place. And I've been lucky enough to do a lot of travel. When I was 19, I spent the summer in New Zealand and Australia with my best friend and college roommate, Camille, and Cammy, as we called her, and I. We bartended in Australia for 2 months, and then we backpacked through New Zealand. When we were backpacking, you know, we were living very cheaply, and we were taking buses around the whole country from the North Island all the way to the South and back up. And every stop, every sort of truck stop, gas station, diner type place along the way served spaghetti sandwiches. Now, this was 25 years ago.
So describe them. Are we talking about like Wonder Bread with spaghetti, overcooked spaghetti drowned in marinara sauce?
Correct. And the bread was pressed into a hot, sort of sealed panini, which when you are 19 years old is pretty awesome. And it probably cost us $1.75 each. I'm sounding really old now. But, you know, and it wasn't the double carb threat at the time that maybe people might think of it now. It was delicious and ridiculous. And we laughed at it and we recognized its sort of hilarity, but it was a local thing. The same way that, you know, Kiwis put fried eggs on their burgers, they eat spaghetti sandwiches. And maybe toasted spaghetti or toasted sandwiches in general were just kind of a new big thing there. You know, now if you go back to New Zealand, their food is extraordinary. So for the book, I came upon the idea of a spaghetti pie, which actually Mario Batali told me last week has some origins in Sicily.
Oh, totally. It's a timbalo.
Well, sure, it's a timbalo. That makes it sound. Yes. This is similar. I don't think Stanley Tucci would approve.
What I love about cookbooks like this is looking into the mind of someone who has been food obsessed forever and has an incredible memory and sense memory, and reminding oneself of your own version of this. So I used to always do spaghetti frittatas with leftover spaghetti, but it's been so long since I've done that.
I think we should.
Yeah, I definitely think we should. So let's come closer to the present day.
Sure.
After you have had the experiences that you reached out for as a young person, which were extraordinary, you seemed very fearless to me, but also informed by this great gig that you have working with Tom and your fellow judges and getting to travel all over. Give us an idea of something that you would serve at home for your husband and your daughter.
Sure. Well, first, let me say that there's a fine line between fearlessness and naivety. I didn't know what I was getting into, so it was easy to do it at the time. Looking back, who knows if I would be able to be as fearless. But there's a lot of things in this book that I serve all the time in my house that are informed by my travels, the way that I like to cook based on the foundation I had going to culinary school and working as a cook for a long time before I got back into media. There's a lot of egg dishes in the book that I love to make because my daughter loves eggs and we make them a lot and spend a lot of time over breakfast because that's the time often in the day when we actually get to cook together.
You've worked with some amazing culinary heavies from Jeffrey Steingarten, Daniel Boulud, Tom Colicchio. I'm curious, who's imparted some of the best advice to you?
All of them, really, in different ways. I mean, Jeffrey taught me how to recipe test. Jeffrey taught me how to do research because that was his philosophy about his exceptional writing was if you do the work, if you do the research, the story writes itself. Danielle Boulud was more like working for someone who was giving me my MBA because that was the first time I worked in the business side of a restaurant. And there were so many things that I learned from him about how to run a business, how to take care of your employees, how to manage people, how to have your finger on every single detail, but still allow the people under you to do their jobs and succeed and thrive. He was an extraordinary boss. He's kind of like my fairy godfather. Tom and I have sort of been roommates for 12 years. We travel the country together and the world. And we spend countless nights at, obviously, at the judge's table. And then we go out for dinner after because we hadn't eaten in at least 5 hours by the time we're finished judge's table. And so over the years, he's really become a confidant and a mentor of mine in a different way entirely because he's never been my boss. But he has certainly taught me an enormous amount about social activism, about understanding food policy. Obviously, those are his passions. And I think he has been so vocal, rightfully so, about the issues that we face in terms of hunger in this country. And that's been invaluable to me.
All this sexual harassment that's been in the news. Do you have a sense that people are really going to start to uncork the depth of what's been going on in the restaurant business?
I feel that that could happen, certainly. I think that we have all become a bit complacent and that somehow we have let boys be boys, and I hate admitting it. I also feel very lucky that I have worked for a diversity of very powerful men in the food industry, and not one of them has ever not been decent to me. So thank goodness for that. There's almost like survivor's guilt that comes with it in a weird way as a woman.
Because you know that women in this business have experienced all manner of...
Yes, and I'm not saying that it's been easy. I mean, I can tell you right now that when I worked in kitchens, two big kitchens that I worked in as a young cook, I was the only woman in both of them. And I'm not saying that there weren't comments and there weren't obscenities and there weren't moments when a fellow chef told me to take it like a man or laughed because I couldn't lift the pot the way he could and I needed to ask for help, or condescended me or truthfully ignored me because I was a woman and made fun of me. That all happened. And most of it was in passing, and it wasn't my bosses, certainly. And I always actually found that the head chefs in the restaurants that I was in actually were exceptional mentors to me. But I do think it's time that we started treating kitchens like businesses, the way that restaurateurs treat their restaurants like businesses. Kitchens need to have policies and safety, and we need to check ourselves and act like adults.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Top Chef Judge Gail Simmons. Her new cookbook is called Bringing It Home, Favorite Recipes from a Life of Adventurous Eating.
We're just mainly interested, if such a culture did exist in our city at a company of such prominence, you know, we wanted to see if we could verify that information and get it out to the public.
That's New Orleans Times Picayune food writer Brett Anderson. We've been talking about his recently published expose on sexual harassment at the Besh Restaurant Group. That group was founded by celebrity chef John Besh. He stepped down from his company shortly after the story broke. The revelations have sparked a conversation about the industry's long-standing culture of abuse. Tell me how this investigation came about.
It began last February, which is Mardi Gras season here in New Orleans, when a friend of mine told me that he had discovered a mutual acquaintance of ours had quit her job in the corporate office of the Besh Restaurant Group. What I remember from what he told me was that I just felt like it was worth giving her a call to find out what was going on. That woman turned out to be Lindsay Reynolds, who's one of the named sources in the story. She had quit her job in a resignation email that I ultimately saw. And in that email and in subsequent interviews with me, she alleged that the company fostered a culture of sexual harassment and discrimination.
Did this come as a blitz from outer space for you, or had you been hearing little bits here and there over the years?
I mean, you know, there's been discussion about gender dynamics in the restaurant industry over these last few years, as you certainly know. So I guess that was in my head, but really I was only interested in, after hearing what Lindsay had to say, in finding out to the best of my ability whether or not it was true. It just led to a bunch of different phone calls, and the trail never really went cold.
Were people eager to talk?
I wouldn't say eager, but that said, I do think over time, I did work quite a long while on the story, and that wasn't because it was difficult to find people with allegations. What takes a longer time is building trust with those people and getting them to understand that I might actually have gathered enough information to get this out there, and that if they speak to me on the record, for instance, that they're not going to be the only people speaking to me on the record. You know, that was sort of the conversation I had around midsummer when I started to talk to people, asking them if they would let me use their name in the story. And, you know, the first couple of women who agreed to do that, they were Lindsay and Maddie Robeson, who are both named in the story. And then after I got those two, and when I spoke to other people, I think that they were a little more willing, knowing that they'd have company.
One of the more striking findings in your story was that the Besh Restaurant Group, which has over 1,000 employees, I believe, did not have a human resources structure to deal with harassment claims until just days before the publication of your article. Did you find this to be at all unusual for a company of this size?
I had not done this sort of business reporting before. You know, I mean, I've always worked at a company that had a human resources department or sort of some sort of structure in place to go to take complaints, you know, should you have them, if you wanted to take them to someone other than your boss, for instance. But, you know, through my reporting, I discovered how unusual it was for these guys not to have that structure. I mean, I guess I assumed that there were small restaurants out there without human resources people, but not companies this size.
This came on the heels of the Harvey Weinstein revelations, which prompted a media firestorm with scores of women coming forward with their stories. Do you think a similar reckoning will start to happen in the dining industry? Recently, restaurateur Jen Ag from Toronto, writing for The New Yorker, suggested that this may in fact be a Harvey Weinstein moment for the restaurant world.
It's very soon, you know, after this has come out, but it does seem at this moment that the conversation around this topic has gotten louder, it's gotten more serious, it's got more action-oriented. It's my hope that that will lead to action, but time will tell. I think that this story sort of entered into a period where people were very receptive and willing to sort of let their anger emanate over new revelations of sexual harassment in our, you know, in our country. But there's a lot of conversations about a lot of different things that are happening out there. And I do hope that the restaurant industry can stay focused on this topic, even after sort of the, I don't know, the outcry that followed our report dies down.
It's interesting, I mean, to remember that you're the dining critic for the paper, and you're constantly reaching out to people to talk about things that are happening in the world of deliciousness in your town. Do you think that chefs and other service workers who you talk to for stories will be more open with you or less open?
That's a pretty good question. When I got into the middle of this reporting, my only interest was in seeing where the facts led, and they led where they did. I've spoken with a lot of people in the restaurant community here in New Orleans since this happened. It's been mostly sort of people voicing their appreciation for it. Whether or not it changes how people interact with me, I just don't know. I mean, I don't think it should. I wasn't out to to punish anyone. This was just a story about something that was happening in our community, as far as I can see. And we, you know, I should also mention that I have colleagues at the Times-Picayune in Todd Price and Ann Maloney, both of who cover the restaurant scene. And Todd, in fact, covers the news a lot more regularly than I do. So there is a bit of distance between me and that kind of reporting. So that, I think, alleviates the potential problem there to some degree.
I should tell you, in case you don't know, that I'm a former restaurateur. I had restaurants.
No, I know that.
I operated restaurants for nearly 30 years. And your story and just the subsequent conversation, I think, has been so important. And it actually caused me to reach out to former female employees of mine and send them an email asking if they had ever experienced any such thing in my restaurant. You know, restaurants are thought of as being such outliers and often not as businesses, and the way we think of as food in this country and how it's served and who it's served by is often part of a story. So I just really think it's very important that you've done this.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you think so. I mean, I do believe that there are customers, restaurant owners, managers, employees down the line. I think there's a feeling out there that restaurant employees perhaps don't enjoy the same job protections as others. Again and again, I heard from the women I spoke to that they went to work expecting to be disrespected in a certain way. That wasn't a conclusion that they'd come to just because they worked for John Besh. These were at other restaurants, that working at other restaurants had led them to feel resigned, this sort of level of disrespect. And I found that very striking. And it did occasion a period where I just had to tell myself and think to myself, these work conditions aren't appropriate. You know, no one should have to go to work feeling scared. And a question that I asked everyone I spoke with who had worked in other restaurants and who had expressed to me the fact that they had been harassed in other restaurants that weren't owned by John Besh, I asked them if their experiences at the Besh restaurants were different. And every single one, save for one or two, said that it was a degree worse.
What sort of feedback have you gotten from your peers in the food media world?
I have to say that I'm incredibly thankful for my newspaper just to have stood behind this reporting, our news organization, I should say, because we're a website as well. But there was never a point at which someone suggested to me, like, there's something, you know, you could be spending your time doing something else. I should say I wasn't surprised by that, but I do feel like people in the journalistic community have expressed a certain amount of surprise at the quote-unquote courage of the Times-Picayune, but I'm not surprised by it.
That's New Orleans Times-Picayune food writer Brett Anderson. He's been talking to me about his investigation of sexual harassment allegations against the Besh Restaurant Group. Coming up, our friend Jonathan Gold brings us this week's restaurant recommendation. Don't go anywhere.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Now let's get a recommendation for eating out. Where are we going?
We're going to Old Town Pasadena. Not a place we've gone a lot, actually.
Yeah, but this is a very particular place, one that I wish I'd gone to with you. I can't wait to go.
It's kind of special. It's Osawa. It's a smallest Japanese restaurant on what I guess is a restaurant row on Raymond, just a couple doors up from the Bone Kettle. To some people, it's a shabu-shabu parlor. To some people, they serve sushi. And to everybody else, it's just a place to stop in for a few bites. It's almost like a perfect modern izakaya.
But the man behind it all is someone of substance.
When I've mentioned who the chef was to Japanese friends, they practically drop to their knees. It's Tachibe-san, the guy who ran all the U.S. Shaya restaurants for like 31 years. Absolutely revered in Japanese food circles. And Sayori Tachibe, his wife. I'm not saying it's their retirement project because they're working super hard, but it's this energy that you can imagine running so many restaurants at the peak of perfection, but it's now focused on this one little place, and it's kind of magical in its way.
So if it's a shabu-shabu parlor to some, a sushi place for others, and sort of like an izakaya for others still, you live in that area. What do you love to eat when you go there?
My favorite thing at the restaurant is batera sushi. It's one of the oldest kinds of sushi. It's fish, which is almost always mackerel, that's been cured, pressed into a mold with vinegared sushi rice, and there's usually like a little slip of kombu on top. And they slice it like a loaf of bread. The oil of the mackerel and the tartness of the rice and the sort of silent umami thing from the thing just melt into this almost explosion of flavor. It's like little bit of soy sauce, maybe some wasabi if you put some on. It's the basis of what sushi should be, I think. And of course, sushi originated as a way of preserving fish, that an oily fish like mackerel or like cojada, the gizzard shad that was the original Batera fish, are very perishable, obviously. And so marinating them slightly and pushing them onto vinegared rice was a way to make them keep so you could eat them later in the afternoon or even the next day.
In your review, you talk about Batera sushi as almost like the working man's version of the kind of sushi that we eat now, nigiri sushi, which is a more elegant presentation.
Yeah, I mean, you go into 7-Elevens in Japan, and you can always find Batera sushi. I mean, you can also find nigiri sushi, but it's not as good. The hoity-toity thing of having so many different kinds to choose from.
Okay, so we're going to have the Batera sushi. Do we have to ask for it? Is it on the menu?
I'm not sure it's even on the menu. It might be by this time because I've been barking about it for so long. And it's not the specialty of the restaurant. It's hard to see what their specialty is. I mean, they even have decent udon noodles. They have chicken and egg bowls.
This place kind of sounds to me like a real-life version of the diner in Tokyo Stories.
I love that show. It almost is. I mean, there's always a lot of kinds of fish you've rarely seen. There's a fish called hobo that they make into a sort of aquapazza. There's sanma, which shows up at lunch counters a lot. It's a long, thin fish, pointy at the end. It's translated sori pike, which doesn't help at all. And it's usually like broiled. But here, at least at this time of year, they do it as sushi. And the delicacy of it is lovely. They do an unaju that I've never seen quite this way, which is, it's kind of like a eel bowl, except that the bowl is rectangular, which has significance. And it's gently seared eel. There's rice. There's a little bit of glaze on it. But somehow together, it tastes like something more than the sum of its parts.
So it's the kind of neighborhood place that you can go to that does sushi well.
Right.
That does noodles well.
Mm-hmm.
That does those really homey dishes like katsudon well.
That will have things on the regular menu like their version of banya cauda, the Piemontese, you know, hot anchovy dip, which they've enriched with miso.
Which is really, really genius. And then they have a deli.
And then they have the deli. The deli is separate. It's on Lake. It's about a mile and a half away. But it's almost like your dream lunch location, or it's my dream lunch location, where I can stop in and I can get the Batera sushi, or I can get a rice bowl, or I can get a plate of tuna rolls, or I can get just some marinated seaweed and have a quick lunch either there or to go. It's an interesting concept, and I wish there were more of them.
That's Jonathan Gold's review of Osawa in Pasadena. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. If you text the words good food to 69866, you'll get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. After the break, an intimate look at the life and legacy of cookbook author Paula Wolfert. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
She just always wanted to understand. And that kind of love of delicious flavors and this endless thirst for knowledge drove her on this 40-year quest to keep finding incredible recipes.
Paula Wolfert may be the most influential cookbook author you've never heard of, writes Emily Kaiser Thelen. Well, I heard of her. She was one of my culinary aunties, a huge mentor. Paula's diagnosis of dementia in 2013 prompted Emily to document Paula's legacy in a book published this year called Unforgettable.
I first met Paula at a food conference. As a groupie, I just approached her and said hi and looked agog and then ran away. But I got to know her when I got to be her editor at Food & Wine magazine, where she was a longtime contributor. when my editor said, hey, would you like to edit the master column? You'd be editing Paula Wolford. My jaw hit the floor. She had been a hero of mine my whole life. And it's a fun story. The column was originally built around Julia Child and Marcella Hazan and Jacques Pepin. And by the time I inherited it, it was Jacques, Jean-Georges von Grischten, and Paula. And for the first two, my boss, Tina Ulaki, gave me the numbers of their personal assistants, but they gave me Paula's home phone number. And when I called her number, she picked up and she said, well, if you're going to be my editor, the first thing you need to know about me is I can't write my way out of a paper bag, which, of course, as you and I both know, is not true at all. But it was the start of a wonderful collaborative relationship.
So when you were just in the groupie stage, what was the book that really spoke to you?
It's fun because she has so many, but the one that absolutely grabbed me is her first, Couscous and Other Good Foods from Morocco. I've never seen a book like it before or since. It was so immersive and romantic, and but also so rigorous, and the recipes were so stellar. And any Moroccan-inspired dish you come across, you can know was touched by that book.
First of all, how did this girl, young woman from Flatbush, who grew up on a regimen dominated by 50s diet food, end up traveling the world and becoming an authority on these flavors that were relatively foreign to American eaters?
Yeah, so she grew up, as you say, in this very non-food-centric household, but she had a grandmother who was from the Balkans, who she spent a year with when she was five in 1943 at the sort of height of World War II, who had a victory garden, who cooked fresh eggplant right out of that garden on the stove and made these very traditional, to Paula's mind, ordinary but layered dishes that, from reading up on food science, I think really seared themselves in her mind. And she had a really close bond with this grandmother, and I think in her most sort of primitive parts of her mind came to associate love with these delicious, real, truly Mediterranean flavors. Because the Balkans, you don't think of it as a Mediterranean region, but it's a crossroads of many Mediterranean cultures. So I think that kind of planted a seed. But how do you, that doesn't automatically spark an 8-book cookbook career. For other reasons, she was blessed with an unrelenting drive. Someone put it to me really well recently. They said her fear of getting it wrong was the only thing stronger than her incredible fears themselves. She's been riddled with anxiety her whole life, but she kind of coped with that anxiety by researching the hell out of things.
It's so fascinating and poignant to realize how riddled with fear she was when she was such a indomitable traveler and immerser into cultures that she knew nothing about during a time when there was no internet. Traveling was a completely different experience than it is now. Could you speak a bit about the way that she was able to ingratiate herself into homes of cooks who were often servants?
I think I wasn't alone in having this misconception that traveling abroad to get people's recipes is a relatively friendly, cozy, romantic affair. Like, who wouldn't want to share their recipe for their family's best bread? But I think people actually don't like to share their recipes. They're very possessive of them and competitive and guarded. And it would only be natural, especially if you're some, you know, Moroccan dada or a real cook servant. Your recipes are your livelihood. You're not about to give them away to some random Jewish lady from Brooklyn. She developed all kinds of canny tricks for getting people to trust her. And her fundamental rule was, I'm here to connect with this person as a human. I'm not here to exploit them for their recipe. And she had all these wonderful ways of doing that. She always made sure to bring a gift wherever she went, even if that meant lugging huge cans of Vermont maple syrup across southwest France to give those out as thank you presents to the various chefs she met. When she knew she was in the presence of someone who really knew what she was they were doing, they formed this really kind of otherworldly bond.
So she's this person who has this incredible, voracious need to connect, both intellectually, technically, and humanly. But she also grew up at this very particular time and was with these men who allowed her to create homes in these far-flung places, in which she ended up being with people who are like who's who of like the beatnik era, and then who's who of the James Beard, Craig Claiborne, Pierre Frani era of American cooking. It's like her life was marked by these profound moments.
Yeah, she really was a fly on the wall at some incredible gatherings. Her first husband, Michael Wolfert, whom she married at the mature age of 19 in 1957, was an aspiring beat novelist who counted among his very close friends Gregory Corso and Peter Orlovsky. So she was buddies with Allen Ginsberg, and his father was a friend of James Beard's editor. So when Paula got into food, it was through the Wolfert family that she was introduced to Beard, but it was through her own pluck that she proved herself to Beard as a capable cook and worthy member of his innermost circle, whom he sort of farmed out as a caterer at various cocktail parties.
So let's talk about these a couple of these books, because they're wildly different yet incredibly similar in her perfectionist teaching of these cuisines. So you mentioned the couscous book, which happened when she was living in Tangier. But then how did the Southwest France book come about? Because I feel like a lot of the people who were cookbook devotees of the time, that's where they discovered her, people who were Julia Child fans and who sort of were interested in a more Western, a more European kind of cooking.
One of the many things that impresses me about her career is that the cookbooks, she has a reputation as something of a free spirit who wrote these books on a whim, but there's a real narrative arc just to the books themselves, and each one got more and more specific as she tried to position something new with every outing. Couscous, you would have thought, made her reputation, but in fact, it wasn't hugely recognized at the time. It was almost overlooked, and in fact, came close to going completely out of print. And she herself stayed in Tangier, wasn't that interested in pursuing a food career, sort of was still casting about for what she wanted to do. It wasn't until the later 70s when she and her second husband, the crime writer Bill Beyer, decided to move back to New York that she realized she should find a career for herself. And she came back to the States and realized she had a very small but devoted following of women home cooks who wanted to be taught the recipes from couscous. And she started going on this sort of cooking teaching circuit, which became a big pathway for how she kind of propagated her ideas, sort of like a traveling missionary. And at the same time, I mean, the late 70s was a really ripe time to land in New York. If you were thinking about a career in food writing, that was the real birth of the American food movement as we now know it. There were half a dozen food magazines opening up and new cooking schools opening up across the country, and a real wave of interest sparked by a lot of different reasons in good food and food of tradition. And Paula is always apt to cast things in the sort of passive voice, like, people were just taken with me. They wanted to know who was this woman who knew so much about Moroccan food. But she was also voraciously curious and competitive and out there to prove herself. And she saw everybody in the late 70s was captivated by Nouvelle Cuisine, which was centered around Paris and a bit to Lyon. So she looked for something that wasn't covered, and she discovered it in the foods of Southwest France.
So let's talk about Paula's diagnosis. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2013, which was the impetus for this project, Unforgettable, which started out on Kickstarter. Is she still able to cook? Is she still fighting her way through using recipes and aroma and flavor?
It's interesting. Alzheimer's has, in very unexpected ways, grounded her and resolved a lot of her struggles with anxiety and trying to find a place in the world. For better or for worse, it has forced her, as she says, to live in the now and to make the best of what she has. But because of the way Alzheimer's sort of goes at the brain, and one of the first things it goes after is your hippocampus, which is what allows you to process new information. I never really thought about this, but even for someone as established and experienced as Paula, cooking is always a kind of conversation between you and the food, and you're always having to process new information, and it's very hard for her to do, and it's kind of stripped of a lot of the joy it used to have. And also, not only because of the processing challenges, but because flavor and aroma are very diminished. It's a real hallmark of all kinds of dementia that those are two of the first things to go. But she has this entirely new relationship with food where she is fascinated by the ways she can use it as medicine. So she is a huge fanatic devotee of the ketogenic diet and is always in flooding my inbox with new articles about the benefits of omega-3 rich wild-caught salmon and grass-fed beef and plant-based diet. And one of her favorites is bulletproof coffee. So in a fun way, she's as obsessive and fanatical as ever, but in this very different direction.
Emily Kaiser-Thelen is the author of Unforgettable, The Bold Flavors of Paula Wolfert's Renegade Life. The culinary biography features over 50 of Paula's classic recipes, and it's out now. Let's turn it over to Laura Avery, who's at the farmer's market with the latest on what's in season.
We're heading into November now, and we're looking at the changing of the seasons, and we're trying to stay inspired with all the beautiful bounty that we have here at the farmer's market. I'm happy to be talking to a chef I had not met before. His name is Doug Mariello. He's executive chef at Gesso, which is a restaurant which just opened a couple weeks ago over at Fairfax and Melrose. And Doug, you're here looking for radishes. So let's talk a little bit about radishes and what it is that you find so interesting about them.
I love radishes. I think they're a very versatile ingredient. In the past, you know, like shaving them on top of a pizza or, you know, just biting into one raw with a little bit of sea salt is always like an amazing treat.
Well, and I think a lot of people think of them as the little condiment you get next to your taco when it comes along on the side. But there are many kinds of radishes. There's the daikon, and then there's the little black ones and the white ones and the red ones. So what kind are you looking for?
Right now, I'm looking for shunkyo radishes. I'm also using purple plum radishes, and I was using ninja radishes for a little bit, and white turnips with their tops, because the tops are so flavorful and amazing as well. They provide an awesome sort of mix of color on a plate, and the pepperiness from the shunkyo is really enjoyable for me.
And the shunkyo is what color?
It's red.
The classic red radish.
Yes, yes, and it's just a lot longer. It's like an elongated sort of finger-like radish.
And the heat-wise, is that one of the hotter ones?
I would say so. I guess like from a peppery sort of aspect, it's definitely got that bite to it.
And what are you going to be doing with these radishes?
I'm going to be roasting them in the wood-burning oven at the restaurant.
Okay, just by themselves?
No, so I basically, very simply actually, I just treat them with salt and pepper and a little olive oil and throw them on a cast iron and hit them right in front of the fire. And then I take the tops and I slice up a little bit of garlic and chili arbol and just get a pan super, super hot and hit it with a little olive oil and do a really quick saute and finish with some red wine vinegar.
And then that all goes on top of something?
Yeah, so I actually utilize the tops another way too, because sometimes I have a little too much. So I make a really nice green tahini where you take your normal sesame paste and add, you know, your sumac, your coriander, your cumin, garlic and lemon zest and all the lovely flavors from that. And you would make it a little thicker than you normally would, so you wouldn't add as much water because you're going to get a lot of hydration from the tops, and you're going to blend it with a little bit of ice so you get that beautiful green pop when you're doing it, and add a little bit of cilantro for bite as well, and it sort of ties in really nicely. I think just making the radish the star of the show is really the important part of this dish.
When did you first discover these red radishes? Because it seems like it's something that a lot of people aren't even aware of.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine, I worked for the Gelina Group for a while, and my friend Max Dornbusch is basically like the know-all of every ingredient ever at the market. And so he brought me these like giant, like finger-weird-looking red radishes and was just so excited about them one day. And I like bit into one, and I thought it was incredible because like, the, you know, the pepperiness, the spice, the crispiness of it, the plating you can use of it, but whether you shave it very thinly along a mandolin and make a beautiful salad out of it, or you can roast it and serve it with a simple, you know, like anchovy aioli, or very cool. It's just a versatile ingredient that got me excited.
Right. Okay. Well, it's good because everybody's now talking about, of course, you know, nose to tail and eat the whole thing and don't waste anything. And so it's great that we're able to like take these sort of underutilized, maybe underappreciated, simple root crops you're talking about and make something really special out of them.
Yeah. I love, you know, making something special out of something that's not there. You know, talking about nose to tail, like, I just got Chris Cosentino's cookbook, Awful Good, which is pretty amazing, and that literally utilizes everything and has me sort of inspired as well.
All right, well, we're inspired by you, and we're always inspired by the market. That's why we come here every week, and so thanks so much for all the pointers and tips, and we will go out and find that radish. What's it called again? The
Shunkyo.
Shunkyo. We will look for that.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
So much.
I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
That was Doug Mariello. He's executive chef at Gesso. Gesso just opened, and Doug was a chef over at the Giusta Group, and now he's out on his own, and he got inspired by a radish, and now so are we. We're talking with one of the farmers now that grows those radishes that Doug was talking about. It's Francisco Garcia from Valdivia Farm down in Carlsbad. And actually, Francisco, as I was walking by your table, I noticed you have about, what, 6, 7 kinds of radishes on your table?
Yeah, that's right. We grow different types of radishes. We grow Easter egg radish, the Shunkyo radish. We also have the French breakfast radish, watermelon radish, just...
And the little red ones.
Yeah. Regular red and regular pink radish.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it's amazing to see when you start looking at radishes, you realize that there are quite a few varieties. Yeah. But the one that Chef Doug was talking about is the Shunkyo, which is the long, skinny one. Tell us about that a little bit. Is that one of your best sellers?
Yeah, it's one. A lot of chefs like it because of the size. Since it's a different type of radish, it's not your regular round radish. It's a longer radish, and they're easier to chop up, like in salads. Mm. And a lot of people use them in pozoles as well.
Do you grow these all year round?
Yes, radish, they're pretty much year-round. Just wintertime, they just are a little bit slower to grow. But, yeah, they're pretty much year-round vegetable.
Do the customers often ask you to take the tops off?
Yes, most of the time the customers want the tops off. So they look for the nice green leaves, but then they ask you to take off the tops.
And why is that?
I have no idea. There's a lot of customers have told me that a lot of people actually juice the tops, but many customers don't really know how to use the tops, so they just tend to just want to throw them away or use them as compost.
Do they, it looks like today they're maybe 3 or 4 inches long. Are you going to let them get any bigger, or do you pull them out?
Sometimes they can get bigger, pretty like 6 inches, 7 inches, mm-hmm. but it just depends.
But do you guys try to tend to harvest them when they're all a little smaller?
Yeah, a little bit smaller because then they're harder to put in the cases to bring them over here. Uh-huh. And then the leaves get real big, as you can tell, so they're harder.
Yeah. Do they start to develop like a hollow core in the middle? If they get too big, do they start getting kind of hollow?
Yeah, because radish usually takes, depending on the type of radish, it can take from 30 days up to 60 days to grow. Like regular radish will take 30 days, and then watermelon radish and black Spanish radish takes like about 60 days to grow. Yeah, and after a while being in the soil, it'll start getting like hollow, and it doesn't have that flavor no more.
All right. So good. Well, we know now that we'll have radishes all year round. You know, we start thinking seasonally at Thanksgiving and Christmas, but radish is going to kind of be a year-round thing. So we'll keep coming back and looking and save those greens because I think they're going to become a thing.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Francisco. That was Francisco Garcia from Valdivia Farm down in Carlsbad, down San Diego County. And they grow about 6 different kinds of radishes, and they're going to be available pretty much all year round. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a minute, we turn to a deli and bakery that's become a Michigan institution. And how? By refusing to take shortcuts and investing in its workers. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
And so someone will say, you know, I remember from my childhood, you know, eating XX and Y, and I can't get it anymore. We're like, well, let's try to make it. Or I remember from this trip when I was in southern Italy, some particular sweet thing that I ate, and we said, well, let's try to make it.
That's Amy Emberling, managing partner of Zingerman's Bakehouse in Ann Arbor, Michigan. When Zingerman's Delicatessen opened in 1982, there were 8 employees and 6 bread recipes. 35 years later, the business includes a retail shop, a baking school, 150 employees, and now a cookbook. I recently spent a few days at this Michigan institution with Amy and Zingerman's co-founder, Ari Weinzweig. Hi.
Hi, Evan.
Hey, Evan.
So, Ari, I guess the first question's for you. How did it all start?
You know, Rebecca Solnit has a great quote that I love, which says something along the lines of, trying to determine where a story begins is like dipping a cup of water in the ocean. The modern version, I guess, I came to Ann Arbor from Chicago to go to school at University of Michigan. I studied Russian history with particular focus on the anarchists, graduated with my history degree, which, of course, there's not a lot of jobs you can get because you have a history degree. Long story short, in my intent to not move back home to Chicago, I took a job as a dishwasher at a local restaurant. And I got lucky because I stumbled into work that I really love, which is working with food and good people, and also into people that I still know and love. Paul Saginaw, my co-founding partner, was the general manager at that restaurant when I started washing dishes. And Frank Carollo, the other, along with Amy, the other managing partner at the Bakehouse, was a line cook. And Maggie Bayless from Zing Train, the managing partner there, was a cocktail waitress. So we're all approaching 40 years of knowing each other and working together, and we still like each other, which is pretty cool. So anyway, Frank started teaching me how to prep and cook the line, and then I started managing kitchens. Fall of 81, actually, it would be right around now. 36 years ago, I gave 2 months' notice, not knowing what I was going to do next. Paul had opened a little fish market across the street from where the deli is now, and he called me and said, hey, there's this cute little building coming open. Let's go check it out. Because he had grown up in Detroit where you could get good deli food. And in Chicago, where I grew up, you could get it, but you couldn't get it here. So we went in there and we looked at this little 1,300 square foot space. And somehow magically, 4.5 months later, we opened the deli March 15th, 1982.
Obviously, I've known about Zingerman's forever. And I've known that it's this collection of businesses. But being there and seeing it is really particular. There's the retail store. There's a huge wholesale business, particularly in bread. There's this long-time, robust mail-order business that predates the internet. How different are the customers of each of those segments, and is it like running three separate businesses?
It is a little bit like running different businesses, but the principles of running business don't really change from one to the other. So we do have retail, and that's one kind of transaction or engagement with the customer. Then bread is quite different from making pastry. I think within pastry, there are some challenges because we are making things for mail order, which have to fit certain criteria to be able to be good by the time somebody receives them in the mail and require a lot of packaging. While we also love to produce some sort of higher end or more complicated pastries that, you know, we only sell in our own stores and at Zingerman's Delicatessen, because we don't want to be driving them all over the place, and they're quite delicate. So in that way, there is some complexity in what we're doing. But, you know, we've had 25 years to get to this point, and Frank has been there the whole time. I've been there most of the time. And so, you know, you gradually add on pieces, and so it's not nearly as daunting as it might be to, like, you on a first visit.
Aside from the quality of the food and its deliciousness, which is just a huge draw to not only residents of Ann Arbor, but people who are traveling through, one of the things that sets Zingerman's apart is the fact that it's this interesting collection of businesses, and that one of them is actually a business called Zing Train, which focuses on the philosophy of business and this idea of servant leadership. Could you talk a bit about that idea?
I mean, in a nutshell, it basically says that the leader's number one responsibility is to serve the organization, not the other way around, which hardly anybody disagrees with when you say it to them. But I would say most businesses are founded, created, and built to serve the purposes of the owners. And this isn't to say we don't want to get something out of it, too. But the point is that we gain the most by serving the organization. Of course, that's easier to say than it is to figure out what the right thing to do to give great service always is. But our point is to help the people in the organization and help the organization get to greatness in the belief that if the organization and the people who are part of it are all getting to greatness, we're doing pretty darn well ourselves, too.
We should say that right now you have a new book out. It's Zingerman's Bakehouse. It's written by Amy, you, in partnership with Frank Carollo. There's such an eclectic mix of recipes in the book. These days when bread, there's such a huge trend for people to learn how to do really serious natural rice bread at home that it's unusual to see a book that combines both bread recipes that start with starters and coffee cake recipes, for example. How did you develop this particular repertoire over the last 25 years?
I was not part of the initial visioning of the Bakehouse. That was Ari with Frank and Paul. Part of the repertoire, and then Ari can add, was, you know, we wanted to make bread for Zingerman's Delicatessen. So we needed to be able to make the Jewish standards, like rye and challah.
Our focus from day one has always been on traditional food. And so we're always, to this day, trying to always dig deeper and go back further. It's probably no coincidence I'm a history major and Amy's married to an archaeologist, but we're always trying to go back to the old ways. And so the naturally leavened breads, to Amy's question, it just was the obvious thing. I mean, this is how the bread was made up until 170 years ago. That's how all the breads were made, was naturally leavened.
As you walk through the bakehouse, what are each of your top temptations?
Well, fortunately, I'm on a high gluten diet, so I can eat everything in there. I really like the country miche bread that we're making. It's 2 kilos. It's actually bigger than 2 kilos.
Bigger.
It's almost 3 kilos, 2.5 kilos, but it's a beautiful loaf. Spelt, the wheat from up north, rye. I mean, it's a fabulous loaf that is, you know, in the tradition of the European countryside, the breads that were really made to last for a week or more.
My first choice in things to eat are usually the components. So just to give you a little window into the world.
She eats raw flour.
Well, I don't eat raw flour, but, you know, a spoonful of pastry cream is really quite delicious. Who needs anything else? Or a spoonful of frangipane, as Ari and I had discussed by email early this morning. Or, you know, what I really love is taking the ends of sesame semolina and dipping it into the chicken fat on the sheet trays. Ooh. When we roast lots
there's
of chickens.
There's a crisp. We might have just invented a new product.
So those are kinds of the things that I can't resist when I'm walking through the bakery. That said, if I have to eat entirely complete items, I'm going to pick a couple of pastry things. Ari's not really a sweet eater, but I am. I love our Boston cream pie. It's in the book. It's just classic. You know, it's so approachable. Chocolate and vanilla, what can you argue about? And the ganache on it is really fantastic. It's not that kind of, you know, waxy chocolate that you often get on baked cakes, but it's really rich, dark chocolate. And then I have to say pecan pie is one of my all-time favorites. If it's in our lunchroom, I can't pass it by. I have to eat at least one little bit of it. We use muscovado brown sugar in it, which makes it really exponentially better than a typical pecan pie, and really great mammoth pecans that get nice and toasty in the oven. And, you know, an all butter crust, which I'm a big fan of. So those are two of my favorites.
Come on over, Evan.
Yeah, when are you coming back?
I hope soon. I've been talking to Amy Emberling and Ari Weinzweig of Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The Bakehouse just celebrated its 25th anniversary with a brand new cookbook called Zingerman's Bakehouse. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download the show wherever you get your podcasts. And a quick favor for you podcast listeners. KCRW wants to learn more about you, who you are, how you listen. So if you have 3 minutes to help us out, go to kcrw.com/survey. Thank you. As always, many thanks to the team that puts Good Food together. Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.